You're listening to Giant Ear on Free 103.9. This is Andrea Williams of the New York Society for Acoustic Ecology. March 2006 show is A People's Cartography. It's about mapping and remapping information for the people, by the people. If we're talking about radical mapping, we should first give a shout out to the late R. Buckminster Fuller, who was the first in the history of cartography to design a map, 1943, that revealed the whole surface of the Earth in a single view, the continents on a flat surface without visible distortion, with Earth as an island in one ocean. Sort of radical democracy in a map. So coming up on today's show, we will have an interview with Wendy Brower of Green Maps. That's conducted by Shasha Feng of Hunter College. And also I interview Andrea Poli. She's a digital media artist working with sonification, and she's also an ISAE member. Also, we will be playing Ben Owen's remix of the New York Sound Map and various other works. So you should check out our playlist that will be up at www.nyacousticecology.org. So now we're going to play the interview that Shasha Feng conducted with Wendy Brower of Green Maps.
You're listening to Giant Ear on Free 103.9. This is Shasha Feng here with Wendy Brower, founder and director of Green Map System.
Hi, Wendy. How are you?
Good, Shasha. How are you today?
Would you introduce our listeners to what Green Map does, a little bit of the history?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Well, to start off, a green map is a locally made map of the natural and cultural environment, and all of them use the same set of icons to help people find places of ecological, social, and cultural significance in their own community.
Great. And how big does Green Maps span? I've looked at your site and there's so many countries and...
Well, here in New York we have a small office, but this is the global headquarters for the project. And, you know, we're constantly creating what people have... collecting what people have created and sharing it back with new Green Map projects around the world. Today there are 334 projects, I believe, in 46 countries. And they're all sizes and scales, led by very different kinds of people for different reasons.
I see your icons are really interesting. How did you come up with the idea to use icons, and who designs them, and what was thought into the design?
Well, the icons kind of bubbled up naturally. I had created the first green apple map of New York in 92, and it was... As it got out around the world, I started hearing from people, mostly by mail, this was pre-email, asking, how did you make the map, and can we make one for our community? And because people had responded well to the little wingdings, and there was a symbol set that was used on our second edition of the map. It was called Animal, actually, early Mac font of animal shapes. Anyhow, I started thinking, wouldn't it be great if we had a universal iconography? Then it really wouldn't matter what language the map was in or who had made it, that the ideas would stand out, the kinds of places and the concepts behind them would stand out, and we'd also have the benefit of having ideas be able to transfer from one place to another. So the model greening initiatives working in one place would have a chance to take hold in another. Plus, you know, icons enliven a map's appearance and they make it resonate with the individual. Maps are very personal objects to begin with. People look for themselves on them. They are incredible power tools. Unlike other kinds of communication devices, they really evoke this connection to place, unlike anything else. So we're trying to put that together with the icons. You asked me how they were, our icons were created. It was great. In 1995, I took this concept of creating iconography, and global iconography and local green maps, and some system to connect all of it to a meeting of the group called O2, which is an international eco design association. You can find it now at o2.org. And at that meeting, which was in Copenhagen, we looked at the net together for the first time, and we talked about how we could use this new medium to further collaborative ecological design initiatives. And I brought through this idea on the table of creating this iconography and green maps, and it was one of the projects that we all decided, let's focus on, and let's all go home and get email. I came back to New York and got the domain name, and we started moving ahead. We actually developed the icons. There were about a dozen people from all from different countries in the first go-round. It took about a year to create them, digitize them as a font, and release them to what had then become about 25 people. They showed up on the first map in print just 3 months later. And in 99, we said, okay, let's look at this iconography. And what's working, what's not working. By then, there was about 60 core group people looking at it, talking about it. And we actually updated it at that point to the current set of 125 symbols that cover everything from economic development and renewable resources and information to the full range of flora, fauna, land and water, as well as the cultural and art sites, and mobility, and toxic hotspots. And this set of 125 is also a font, so it works with any computer program. We provide it on stickers to folks who do not have computers or choose not to use them. They've also been hand-drawn a million times by kids making green maps. Currently, we're in the process of updating it to version 3. Our understanding of sustainability has grown significantly in the past 6 years, as well as how to communicate with the public. So we're having a system-wide review of the icons, and hopefully by the end of 2007, we'll have a new iconography set up. Maybe it'll be sooner, but we're taking kind of a slow food approach to its development. So we're not trying to rush through.
Have you ever had the problem of multiple icons for one set of data or one set of things? And how do you decide on which one would be the best?
It comes up often. And so our maps, we have more than one. If you look at our new powerful green map or the our youth map of Lower Manhattan, we chose several. I mean, we limited it to 6, I think. But there is one main one for each one. It is difficult for people to pinpoint, and we don't necessarily want... Well, I should say there's a general definition for each icon, but it must be set in the local context by the local map makers and their group of people working together. So, yes, there is always discussion, and that's part of the goal. How do you set your own criteria for using them? So many of the maps include the criteria either on them or on the website, trying to be transparent about it. How were these places selected? Many times it's a more flexible kind of criteria than a very set and dry. For example, in Copenhagen, if you don't have 85% organic ingredients, your organic cafe is not going to show up on the map. If we stuck with that standard here in New York, we'd have no organic restaurants on the map. So it has to be done locally. And business-related ones are often the most difficult for people to agree upon.
Okay, great. How do your maps let people experience space differently compared to a regular map that anyone can pick up in the atlas?
Many maps are focused on roads and car culture, and I think that's one of the big differences from ours. We're focused on green space and seeing the patterns of sustainability and where which neighborhoods have, for example, invested the most in community gardens and green shops and other livability kind of places. Which neighborhoods are being left out? Is this an environmental justice issue? Is this poor planning? So they maybe help people who are thinking about moving where they want to locate differently. We've had maps that leave off the roads altogether, and the only thing that's on there is the bicycling and walking paths, the car-free pathways are on there. I guess part of what it does is it helps people understand that nature is all around us, and that you have the experience to be a hometown ecotourist just by kind of walking across town. It helps people discover what's going on nearby them that needs their support and engagement to grow stronger. So.
And how can people find Green Map here in New York City?
Here in New York City, well, our newest maps, which is all about energy, impacts, conservation, and renewables, but set in the context of the whole environment, they're free. This map was actually a good place to pick it up is the Green Market. The main one has them. Many of the green markets around town will soon have them available at the market manager's table. You can check our website for New York, which is greenapplemap.org, and there's a list of pickup points there. And in fact, if any listeners want to make a new pickup point in their neighborhood, we'll be glad to send maps and a little rack and add that spot to our list on the map. Upcoming events, well, not quite sure when this will be aired, but for example, if you go to the Earth Day Fair at Grand Central, you'll be able to pick it up, or Central Park. Lots of green places will have it soon. And we also have a store on our website. If you want to help us out a little, you can actually buy a couple copies. We have a poster version of it as well there.
And so far, who uses Green Map, like your target audience?
Well, that's a tricky one. For the powerful Green Map, we really thought everybody is our target audience. And that's why if you go to our website, you'll see that there's Chinese and Spanish. The beginning of the map there in terms of tips and links in those languages. I think ours might be some of the very first information in Chinese about energy conservation, New York specific. A lot of people haven't been invited to be part of the energy conservation solution yet in this city, and so we're trying to help with that situation. I think our audience... really, though, is people from high school age and up in the city who are part of the real thing, and it is saving money. And who isn't interested in that in this city? Our last edition was LOMAP, Lower Manhattan Youth Map, so for kids and their families. And it's turned out to be very popular with tourists. It's kind of a fun, really fun view of Lower Manhattan. That's easy to download from greenapplemap.org. By the way, our main website, greenmap.org, you can see about 65 different online maps created around the world, all using different technologies. So it's interesting from a comparative point of view. Our third website is greenatlas.org, and there you can download in-depth, behind-the-map stories from 10 key places in Asia and North America.
That's amazing.
Yeah. In Japanese or English.
Are there any ongoing projects that you're working on right now, and how can people participate?
Well, one cool thing we're hoping to have up in the next month or two, let's say by June for sure, if we're lucky, we're going to be connecting our database to Google Map, and we're going to be adding a public site nomination platform, so you'll be able to put your green sites right on that map. We also are going to collect the impacts of our map. It's been around for about 10 years. Has it changed people's lives at all? So that's part of what we want to see on there. So listeners can certainly add that. Our new map has a link on it to New York Acoustic Society, so maybe people will be interested in telling us more about some of the soundscapes and really beautiful, quiet places in the city as well.
Is there anything else you would like to add?
We're at the tipping point right now in terms of climate change and sustainability and what individuals can do. And the fact is, we need every single person involved in it, whether they're don't feel they have any influence or that their actions don't matter. That's not true anymore. It's everybody needs to get involved. So I'd like to see your listeners who are involved in maybe the world of art and sound to get on board. and start seeing what they can do to change things. We're definitely at a moment where we need everybody to be thinking and working towards it. So that's what I would like. You know, one thing we love is student interns and volunteers who can help us with some of the digital work we're doing around here. We're constantly building out new resources and would love to hear from people. Email me, web@greenmap.org, if you might be interested. Thanks.
Great. Thank you, Wendy. And this concludes our interview.
Thank you.
Okay, that was interview with Wendy Brower of Green Maps, conducted by Shasha Feng. So now we're going to be playing Ben Owen's mix of the New York sound map. I'm just going to read from our page here at the New York sound map.org about the project. Maps are tools for understanding the world from different points of view, political, cultural, personal, and historical. Maps hold the power to shape the truth about the world, and mapmakers shape the future. The New York Sound Map is a container, a concept or idea to hold many types of processes and projects. The project reaches across the city's geographic, economic, educational, cultural, and racial divides. It is at once a historical record and a subjective representation of the city. It is what each user wishes it to be and is ever-growing, ever-changing, and totally interactive. So please participate. Send in your sounds. It goes to a Google Map we call Sound Seeker. And you can either participate, or if you'd like, you can just come and listen to points all over the city. So here we go. We're going to be playing a long section. It's going to be about a half hour of sounds that have been contributed to the map as of, I guess it was February 4th, 2006. Here we go.
No, Thank you. authentic.
That was Ben Owens mixing of the New York Sound Map. The Nisei will be presenting the New York Sound Map at, along with other artists, at Participant Inc. Gallery this Tuesday, March 28th, 6:30 to 9 p.m. That's at Participant Inc. Gallery, and it's at 95 Rivington Street. We will be presenting the Sound Map, and also Hisdom, a.k.a. Johan Hartman, will be live mixing the New York Sound Map from about 8 to 9 p.m., so you should come by and check that out. Should be a lot of fun. And coming up, we're going to be playing an interview I conducted with digital media artist who works with Sonification. She's also a Nisei member. Also, many other things, many other projects. She's great. This is an interview with Andrea Poli. You're listening to Giant Ear on Free 103.9. This is Andrea Williams here at Hunter College with digital media artist and fellow Nisei member, Andrea Poli. Her work addresses issues related to science and technology in contemporary society. Her many projects, exhibited worldwide, often bring together artists and scientists from various disciplines. Andrea is currently working in collaboration with atmospheric scientists to develop systems for understanding storms and climate through sound, a creative mapping of the impact of climate on the future of human life, both locally and globally. Hi, Andrea. How are you?
Hey, great. Nice to be here.
Thank you so much for having this interview. Now, you have many projects going on, along with being the director of the Integrated Media Arts Program here at Hunter. Could you tell me more about your work with scientists, like how that collaborative relationship formed, and also what you do with the data?
Well, the first time I started working with an atmospheric scientist was in 2000, and I participated in a workshop on collaboration at the Annenberg Center in California. And there was a bunch of us, and half of us were artists and half of us were scientists, and we were in L.A., And so anywhere we went, we were taking these buses. And they would take, like, you know, 2 hours to get anywhere, of course, because it's L.A. So one of the times, I ended up sitting next to Glenn Van Noe, who's a meteorological scientist who works at a company called Mezzo up in Albany. And he and I just started talking, and I was telling him a little bit about my work with eye tracking and sound, and how I had done some work previously, some algorithmic music using the Lorenz attractor. And he was telling me about how the Lorenz attractor was a mathematical formula that was really important to meteorologists, which I kind of knew a little bit about from doing it. But he was telling me a lot of the details about it, and he was like, wow, it's really cool to think that that was turned into sound. And he said, you know, the models today are a lot more complicated. They take into effect, like, things, for example, whether or not there's a city somewhere or it's farmland. They take into effect the chemical composition of the air, all kinds of things. So you basically got this gigantic series of computer programs and mathematical formulas that represent almost, you know, as much detail as possible of the entire Earth. It's really pretty fascinating. And he said, you know, what if you were to turn this much more complicated model into sound? I wonder what that would sound like. And I was like, wow, that's amazing, and I'd love to try it. So we started working together, and we worked together for about a year on a project called Atmospherics Weatherworks. And for that we showed at Engine 27, and it was a 16-channel installation, sound installation, that was a sonifications of two storms that occurred in the New York City area. One was the 1979 President's Day snowstorm, and the other was Hurricane Bob from 1991. And the reason we picked those two storms was that the first one was really important to the meteorologists, because the meteorological community, because it was totally a surprise. And after it happened, the meteorologist said, wow, what's wrong with our models that we didn't know that this was coming? And so it sparked this huge resurgence of research and the development of new meteorological models that influence the models today. So that was kind of a classic storm to them. And then the path that storm took was very similar to the Hurricane Bob from 1991. So that's kind of how we chose those two. We wanted something that went through New York, because the show was going to be in New York, of course. And we wanted something that wasn't too distant in the future, that there'd be good models and things. And we also chose two different types of storms, a winter snowstorm and a hurricane, because the scientists wanted to find out if we would be able to hear differences between those two types of storms. And we definitely did, and it was a lot of fun. And that was in, I think, 2002. I'm not even remembering. And then since then, I started working with some climate scientists at the NASA Goddard Institute, and we did sonifications of climate. And then I've been working most recently with a snow and ice specialist on real-time climate up from the North Pole. So those are kind of the three projects.
Okay. I guess this would be a good time to play a little excerpt of your Arctic work.
Oh, great.
Thank you. Thank you. So could you tell us what you do with the data?
Well, there is a number of different approaches. You know, the most direct kind of thing is to say, okay, I have data happening over time, and I'll use it to change various parameters of the sound. So, for example, you could use the data to change pitch of a sound. So if a number goes up, pitch goes up. But you could also change, or you could use it to change volume, for example, a real basic one. Number goes up, gets louder. But there are other sort of more subtle approaches that I've been really interested in, and just through working on the storm sonifications, I've sort of found that these kinds of things work. For example, using filtering. So taking a really rich sound, a sound that's really has a wide spectrum, and filtering the sound using the data will sometimes create different kinds of interesting sounds. I mean, sort of philosophically, when I started doing that, I was thinking about things like wind harmonics and the way the sound of wind, like you know, noise, basically white noise. When it's filtered through an architectural space, changes its sound, and you know, can make these really beautiful whistling sounds and things. So I was interested in that. What I'm doing, I'm not really creating a physical model of an architectural space or anything and sending noise through it, but I'm kind of conceptually doing that same sort of thing by sculpting it with different types of bandpass filters and low and high pass filters.
Is that what you did for the Arctic work?
For the Arctic work, I worked with a English sound artist and programmer, Joe Gilmore, and that was really exciting because he also brought his own ideas about sonification into the work as well. So part of what you're hearing is noise and really rich samples being filtered, but you're also hearing things like what he does is more of an additive process. So he's taking sine waves and kind of building them up and mixing them in different ways based on the data. And so that's where you hear a lot of the higher pitched kind of sounds.
Okay. So you're working with a lot of data with scientists, but I was curious what you would say are your creative findings through listening and through your collaborations.
Oh, that's interesting. I think I'm always fascinated in kind of the ways the natural world. I'm always fascinated in sort of the beauty of the natural world. I think it's really important that we appreciate and connect with our world. And I think it's something that we're really not doing enough of right now. I mean, talking about the Arctic, that sonification, you know, every day, as a matter of fact, just this morning, there was another article about the melting of the polar ice cap. And, you know, we're doing that. You know, humankind is making that happen. And it's not necessarily something that's going to destroy the Earth. You know, the Earth isn't going to blow up because the polar ice caps are melting, but humanity is going to suffer a lot. You know, many people, including probably a lot of us in New York because of the sea level rise and stuff. So for me, I think the kinds of things that I'm doing, my goals, I guess, and I don't know if you'd call these creative goals or political goals or, you know, I don't know. but
both.
Right, but yeah. So my goal is to not so much to like alarm people, but to make people appreciate these natural forces, you know, through listening. And listening, you know, is a really intimate kind of a thing, and I think it's really wonderful the possibility of having that kind of intimate communion, if you say you might say, with the world and these like constant forces in the world that are happening.
I got a chance to listen to some of your work. It was a hurricane data piece last year. No, I think the year before.
Mm-hmm.
Through Stefan Moore's 16 channels speaker array. So there, it was just in a big room. It was practicing for an actual exhibit, I think. Mm-hmm. And wow, I mean, you just see the tech gear everywhere. But I really, listening, I felt like I was inside a hurricane.
Oh, cool.
It was really great. It's really powerful work.
Thanks.
And so we were talking about the Arctic work, and so do you have any shows, exhibits coming up where people can experience?
On April 8th at Exit Art, which is on, I think, 34th and Street and 10th Avenue, there's going to be an exhibit called The Drop, and it's a bunch of different artists who are dealing with the issue of water, and specifically the upcoming water shortage that's happening. It's actually happening right now. And the piece Endpoint, my collaborative piece with Joe Gilmore, will be shown there. And that piece includes not only the sonifications of climate in real time from the North Pole, but also webcam images from the North Pole over the past few years, and also the most current webcam images.
Great.
So come and check it out. Yeah, Exit Art, April 8th.
Okay. I will be there. Okay. Well, thank you, Andrea Poli. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Giant Ear on Free 103.9. That was Andrea Poli, digital media artist and fellow NYSE member.
Now we're going to be playing some Sony Ericsson recordings from Jeremy Slater, a little medley. Normally he takes these things and makes sound, video works out of them, but here they are, stripped down for you. It's going to start off with Ocean 1, then Water, Cell, and Rain, and then Memo 1, which was a subway musician and 42nd and 8th Subway A-Train, and finally Chinatown New Year's will be the last piece. And here we go. was Jeremy Slater, with recordings that were taken mostly from his Sony Ericsson cell phone. You can find out more about Jeremy's work. He works with field recordings and various other sounds to make sound and video works. And his website is listed, along with a playlist, at www.nyacousticecology.org. Coming up, we're going to be playing Bankery Ears, which is a piece by Pete Stollery, which was from November 2004. It was for a commission by the Woodend Arts Association, which is in Bankery in Aberdeenshire, Scotland. And what he did was he took sonic photographs of Bankery, and he took them back to his studio, and he created a sound environment that he hoped would create images in listeners' minds. And to me, it's kind of goes along with our sound map, which is kind of a mapping of culture, of people. Same as Jeremy Slater's work. His was located in Manhattan. This is in Scotland. And you can find these recordings on Far Afield, which is a CD put out by Webbed Hand Records in 2005. And also, we're going to be finishing up the show with two works by the Phonographers Union, which is on a CD called Live on Sonarchy Radio. And we'll be playing track 4 and track 8. And Christopher De Laurenti, who was at our NYSE meeting as a special guest this month, is on the CD. He takes part in Phonographers Union. And we thank him for visiting with us. And we will be playing, I guess there was like a dinner. There was a dinner, or there was a brunch that I missed that we will be playing on a future show. Thank you for tuning in to Giant Ear on Free 103.9, a people's cartography show about mapping and remapping. And please come out for Surge event. That is on March 28th from 6:30 to 9 p.m. at Participant Inc. Gallery in Lower East Side. And stay tuned for next month's show, which is April 30th, I believe, and it's called What? The NYSE Get Their Hearing Tested. We are going to be getting our hearing tested and recording it. And please send in your works that have anything to do with Noise Awareness Day, which is April 20th or 26th. I have to look that up. But please send in your sounds to me at lemurs66@yahoo.com. Here's Bankery Ears by Pete Stollery, followed by the Phonographers Union. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you.
the world with you. Most intimidating. If that river was in state, it was most terribly, I suppose, if you just say, frightening. And, I mean, when I was at school, the October holiday was the Tatty Holidays. And all the children went out and got their tatties. And there again, there's a definite sounds that the machine is this wheel is rotating all the time, stirring up the ground and releasing the tatties from the ground. So there is a definite sound there as well.
Thank you.
and something happens within the machine and it binds it with the twine. And then it throws it out, and there's a click.
Thank you. Oregon. Thank you. Thank you.